I'm sorry, but I don't want to be an emperor. I don't want to rule or conquer anyone. I should like to help everyone if possible. We all want to help one another. Human beings are like that. We want to live by each other's happiness, not by each other's misery. We don't want to hate and despise one another. In this world, there's room for everyone, and the good earth is rich and can provide for everyone. The way of life can be free and beautiful, but we have lost the way. Greed has poisoned men's souls.
So if you are materialistically focused and you're disconnected from the spiritual, compassionate part, we can all see that and point at that and go, oh, how terrible. But when we see the atheist Heather Berg USC disconnect, we're unable to do the same and say, well, your compassion is disconnected from the deeper spiritual reality.
Cries out for universal brotherhood, for the unity of us all. Even now, my voice is reaching millions throughout the world. Millions of despairing men, women, and little children. Victims of a system that makes men torture and imprison innocent people.
Ask ourselves consistently, am I evil? It's almost like the opposite of if you can ask yourself if you're crazy, then you're not crazy. If you can ask yourself if you're evil, then you actually do have the potential to become evil. Because if you never ask, then you're just in this way of compulsive sleepwalking forces like everybody else. And, you know, nothing you do is really evil, but also nothing you do is really good. Like, you're not really acting out of intention at all. So you're not really able to extend love and compassion for real in an intentional, purposeful, and meaningful way to people. And that is the gift of the possibility of evil to us. That's the gift of free will to us, is that the separation, the ability to do evil, means that if we look at that, we ask ourselves that, then we can do good in the world.
I have an interview coming up in a minute with Connor Habib, and you just heard both of us talking over the very great and famous Charlie Chaplin clip from The Great Dictator. And while I almost feel like we can't possibly do justice to a clip like that, I did want to set the stage for a discussion that I feel like has been going on in the background here on Skeptico for a while, and that is the link, or maybe better said, the disconnect between spirituality and progressive social thinking. I mean, when you listen to Charlie Chaplin, who the heck disagrees with any of that? But at the same time, does anything Charlie Chaplin is saying there, does any of that make any sense if there isn't a larger spiritual reality? So in this interview, we talk about that. It takes us a little while to get there. There's a lot of other things that Connor and I talk about. It was a great chat, a really interesting chat, and I appreciate having the opportunity to talk to Connor since I've known him for quite some time and he's never been on Skeptico. Hey, one other note. I do so appreciate everyone connecting with me. It's been awesome. If you haven't heard, I guess I'm putting out the word there that I'm here and I'd love to hear from you. And while I'm at it, I guess I'd also put out the word that let your friends know about Skeptico. I know many of you have, but they probably forgot. I'd love to grow this community only as much as it's supposed to grow. So as I just said that, I take that back. Don't tell anyone about Skeptico that isn't supposed to know about it. But if you know someone who is supposed to know about it, who's supposed to come in here and join our dialogue, please let them know. Okay, on to my interview with Connor Habib. Today we welcome Connor Habib to Skeptico. Connor is an author, lecturer, and host of Against Everyone with Connor Habib, which you will find on YouTube, and also he has a download of it in podcast form. So, Connor, welcome to Skeptico. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Alex. I should correct you and you should start over because it's mostly a podcast now. You can only get the YouTube if you are a Patreon patron. I just changed that like a week ago. So do you want to start that over again?
No, I'm not going to, because that's how you sucker people in. I've gone to YouTube and You have the 10 minutes there and then you say, hey.
Oh, yeah. Okay, good. All right. Damn it. I shouldn't have stopped you. You know what you're doing. You're better at that part than I am. All right.
Oh, no, man. We can talk a little bit about that. You get some really good guests on there. And it's pretty amazing. And I was on there. You were so nice to have me on there. And I really enjoyed it. I think we had a great conversation. You are really quite good at asking these questions and bringing these dialogues in places where a lot of people don't go. And that's why I was so excited to have you on. But I had to say, you know, when we set this up, I could have sworn that you had been on Skeptico before because we've known each other for a long time and we've had all these great conversations. And then I checked and you hadn't, and I felt like, wow, what am I doing? How come I haven't had a car on before?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you noticed that discrepancy because I've been listening to the show. I probably listen to almost every episode at this point, which by now is a lot, and I've been listening to it for years and years. And our first conversation was, you know, when I had this sort of, you know, failed attempt to start a podcast years ago, and I was a big Skeptico fan. I interviewed you, and we talked about science. We talked a lot about Richard Dawkins. It seems things have come a long way since the content of that conversation. And it seems like our concerns are not the same. Well, I mean, we still are concerned about that, but we've kind of moved past those, that kind of focus.
Isn't that cool? Yeah. I mean, I do have to look back every now and then and say, wow, you know, maybe we all have collectively accomplished something in terms of moving the ball forward a little bit in that, you know, it just came up again today when, not today, but recently, someone sent me a link to Bernardo Kastrup, a friend of the show, a great writer, and he was kind of railing against some skeptics, and it just didn't. Bernardo was totally in the right, and it was just irresponsible what had been done. But, you know, it didn't have this quite the same teeth to it on either side. I mean, it was just so clearly that obvious that the skeptics had no place to stand. They weren't getting any traction with their outrage and their big, stupid throwing a hissy fit. And it just did feel like, wow, that thing is over.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I wonder, is it over, or are we just not paying attention to it? But it certainly is not looming as large in the cultural conversation in an urgent way anymore. That is for sure. And I don't know exactly why. I mean, well, I do know why for some reasons, but I don't know the total reason why. And that'd be interesting to sort of think about, because I think people still do have majorly dismissive attitudes towards spirituality and the paranormal and the occult and consciousness that's not locked into the brain or created by the brain and all that. I think a lot of people are very still dismissive of that, but it's not like the urgency of that concern has sort of subsided in some way. And there's been a little more wiggle room, I would say, for sure, to talk about these things. Now, maybe not quite as much in a university setting or, you know, if you went to some sort of progressive political place, but I do think something shifted, and you definitely assisted that. I mean, honestly, and I'm not just saying this to, to praise you at the start of your episode, before we get into it, but it's like giving your boss a drink before the meeting. But I do think that, like, you know, having such an intense document of how near-death experiences do and do not work that's just available to the public, I think it's a great service. Even though you've moved beyond that on the content of this show, I think just having that document is really important because you just point people to it now, you know?
Well, that's nice of you to say, and I appreciate it. I'd circle back to what you said earlier about, you know, what the difference is, because I think it's kind of a little bit of a interesting side digression conversation to have here before we get into the meat of what we're going to talk about with you and I. But the way that I think I noticed the shift has occurred is those people have kind of switched places with us in a little bit, in that there's almost a little bit of reluctance or trepidation on their part to speak of, you know, that kind of, well, I just am proud to be an atheist, biological robot, meaningless universe person. You know, they're kind of like looking around like, can I really say this, or am I going to be the one who looks like I'm the odd person out? I think that's really what I notice, is that there's a different tone to where they say, how they say it.
Mm. That's interesting. I'll have to think about that more for sure. Because I think that people are, I think you're right. Like, they're not forthcoming in saying it like that. Like, it's not, we don't live in this like Daniel Dennett playground anymore. But I do think when others bring up spirituality, or that the mind is not equal brain, they're still pretty quick to be vocal about dismissing it. So they might not volunteer it, but they're still right there to shut you down if you bring it up, which is a different problem, I think, you know?
Well, in a way, that kind of leads into the first thing I want to talk to you about, because we just spoke a couple weeks ago, and I was really excited to hear about this new journey that you're launching into in terms of getting a PhD in a very, very interesting thesis area that is so right up your alley. And I have to say, before this talk, you had to kind of make sure that I wasn't going to release this beforehand, because this is like breaking news for Conor Habib fans and their Conor Habib world out there. So before we even get into that and talk about your soon-to-be PhD thesis and the new venture that you're getting into, let me back up. Tell folks a little bit about who is Conor Habib.
Yeah, okay. So, gosh, there's a lot there, because I feel like I've lived a lot of different lives, some of them clumsier than others. But So I host this podcast, Against Everyone with Conor Habib. That's my main thing right now. And that came out of wanting to have serious discussions about complex spiritual and philosophical and political ideas, because those are often shut down when they start getting deep. It's like you talk about on your show, where you say, well, there's the level one discussion, the level two discussion, the level three. The level three almost never happens, because people get like stuck in the level one. And I always wanted to have those level three discussions, but I wanted to share them with people in like an engaging way that was accessible. So it wasn't also like just keeping people out, and it was inspiring them to have their own conversations, because I hate small talk. It drives me crazy. I mean, obviously I can do it, and I do it a little bit here and there, but I want to get into the meat of things, you know? And so, that's my sort of main focus right now, is having this show, which I have journalists. I mean, the shared guest really would be you and Gordon White have both been on the show. And I haven't had really a lot of scientists yet, but I have political journalists, writers, artists, comedians, musicians, all that. And I think, for me, it's about exploring ideas. Now, that came out of, that's my most recent venture that's emerging out of having been a sex workers' rights advocate and activist for 10 years, and also having been a porn performer for almost 10 years. And all those things sort of mesh together for me, because I've done this thing my whole life where I've tried to be an outsider to the community that I entered into, in a way, because I think it's useful. So, you know, I went to school for grad school for creative writing, and I was also studying the sciences. So I was in the humanities by studying organismic and evolutionary biology with Lynn Margulies at University of Massachusetts. So humanities and sciences. But then I was also a very spiritual person, really getting deeply into the work of Rudolf Steiner, particularly, who's still sort of my headquarters, and I know just came up on your Mark Booth episode quite a bit. And then from there, also then started doing porn and sex work. So humanities, but in the sciences. In the sciences, but in spirituality, but doing sex work. And so all that sort of outsiderness has created a weird web of connections, I think it can feel lonely and frustrating sometimes, but also has allowed me to sort of see connections between things that maybe other people don't get to see sometimes, or at least lets me sort of try out ideas publicly through my life that I think other people, either haven't or haven't really thought of before. And I mean, not that I feel like I sound like I'm like bragging or something, but I think it's just true about my life. It's an unusual life pathway.
I would agree. I think you bring an interesting perspective on that. And I would have to add to the part about the episodes you've done of Against Everyone. One thing I really appreciate about what you do, and I love the way you said it, you know, it's like you hate small talk. And I can so relate to that. I mean, for my whole life, I was like, why are people talking about such meaningless, stupid things? It's like, remember when you were a kid, you know, and people were like advising you, you know, don't ever talk about religion or politics. You know?
Right.
It's like, why the fuck not? Isn't that like, spirituality? Isn't that fundamentally like the most important? We all know that's the most important question, however we feel about it, whether we're atheists or whether we're the most orthodox fundamentalist, whatever, you know, isn't that? And then politics, or, you know, however you want to position that in your head in terms of deep state conspiracy or Republican, Democrat, it's the forces that are most present and pressing on you, on your life. You know, like, that's so telling that that would be the advice, at least that I got. And I'm sure you, being a kid in Pennsylvania with kind of.
I'm an adult, man. Like, so when I went to grad school, you know, this is the place where it's supposed to be, where people really go to learn and investigate questions about culture. And I remember like twice I got sort of gasps and audible gasps from the other students in class. And one was when I said something about sex, and another was when I said something about God. And without going into all the details of that story, I noticed, I was like, this is really interesting that these two things are off the table. But I know that all the grad students for sure are thinking about sex all the time. and I know that also, like, God and religion has had a role in their lives. So what's the problem here? We're not even allowed to really discuss it or go into it at all. And I think that, you know, what you pulled on too is like politics and also money, you know, these taboos, like, you know, as you point out again and again, like, the taboos are constructed by our culture and people and institutions and forces of power in one way or another over time. And so those are there for a reason. It's not just some incidental thing like, don't talk about politics. What? You know, like, don't talk about sex. Don't talk about. And so that's part of why I want to have those conversations, is like, it's sort of a counter, you know, I call it a countercultural podcast, but it's really sort of a counter power podcast in some way. It's like, maybe if we talk about these things out loud and really go into them, it'll inspire other people to do that instead of just being like, oh, you know, I don't really think deeply about things, or that's depressing, or that's not polite, or, you know, whatever way they use to evade it and keep in lockstep with the kinds of conversations people and institutions in power want us to be having, which are about bullshit.
Yeah, that's great. And I just really commend you, because it's really brave the way you do tackle some of this stuff. And, you know, when I first encountered you, and we were just kind of talking, like you said, you interviewed me about Skeptico, and it was a really interesting interview. You were on your game. You're talking about all the right stuff. And then, you know, you kind of lay this whole, hey, I'm interested in, you know, the sex angle, and by the way, I'm a gay porn star. And it's like, that is so jarring. And it was jarring to me too. I can't like pretend it wasn't. But what was so cool is that I got a chance to know you on this kind of intellectual level, even if it was just a little bit. And I was like, how brave for this person to kind of put themselves out there and go, no, you know, I just want to talk about Rudolf Steiner and how that relates to, you know, your ideas in terms of extended consciousness and rhythms. And then, by the way, this is also a part of who I am, and I'm okay with it, and I'm okay with integrating it, or I'm still working on integrating it, because we're all working on integrating all the parts of us. So I've always admired the bravery that you have in just kind of putting it out there and saying, let's see how these things fit. And I think it fits, it backs up perfectly what you're saying. And in a way, with that just being kind of a little bit of a admiration society kind of thing, it kind of leads into this PhD program that you're getting involved with, and the thesis. And I don't want to say thesis, because you're not that far along. But what you described to me, I thought was so skeptico, if you would, you know, so perfect. And so as soon as I heard it, I was like, wow, how has no one done that before? Why hasn't anyone explored that? Which, of course, is the perfect, you know, ground for a PhD. So tell us, let's relive that conversation we were having and tell us what you're thinking about in terms of what interests you, and tell us about the PhD program in general, because I want to help you, you know, make that happen. And I hope other skeptical listeners can get behind your Patreon thing and help you make that happen, because it's research that needs to happen.
Yeah, thank you. So, okay, so the very short version of it is that I'm going to get a PhD studying for, it'll be a long time, probably 5 years or more, doing research on how people are stigmatized, shamed, and ridiculed in the media by their families and, you know, in other ways for having paranormal and occult experiences, or being paranormal or occult investigators. So, and one of the ways, and one of the things that sort of like is strange about this is that even though we know when someone has a sustained paranormal experience, so when I say sustained, I mean, you know, when someone just says, oh, I was like thinking about somebody calling me and then they called, we can talk about that and laugh. Or if someone says, oh, I saw a UFO once, even if that happens, we can talk about it in sort of a lighthearted way. But if someone has a sustained experience, if they're encountering something again and again, and they need help, or they're trying to interpret or understand the experience, then it enters into a whole different dimension. So first of all, that's interesting to me, why these sort of levels of stigma and shaming happen. But when the thing that's interesting about it is that we consume narratives about the paranormal and the occult and the sort of strangely spiritual all the time. They're hugely popular in the form of horror movies and horror narratives. And so we flock to those. Even if a horror movie is bad, it usually makes money because people are really into it. And yet it's also critically panned, right? So this is something I noticed from making porn. This is one of the associations I made, which was like, porn is wildly popular, yet it is never, I mean, except, you know, for a brief moment, really, in like the 70s, like considered an art form, like really taken seriously and talked about in a culturally critical, thoughtful, investigative way, whether, you know, good or bad, is just sort of dismissed, you know, from the get-go as an art form. And porn and horror movies experience the same issue, where it's just like they're critically panned and they're laughed at, and yet they're wildly popular. So to me, I thought, is this some weird symptom? This almost seems like a strange symptom of like repression, where like the repression is like rising to the surface because we're keeping these experiences to ourselves because we know that there'll be repercussions if we talk about them. And yet, as a culture, we celebrate fictionalized accounts of these experiences. So those were sort of the two parts that got me interested in this big long-term project, which will be an anthropological project, PhD, in Ireland. So that's the other part. I wanted to be somewhere where questions of belief and science were in a sort of strange place because of the way the religious landscape and the sort of more materialistic landscape are still evolving and unfolding there. I'm really excited to do this project. I haven't started yet. I mean, I've obviously done some pre-research and, you know, written out my research project outline and all that sort of stuff. And I've had a lot of conversations about it with people who have had paranormal experiences, and I've taken notes and also talked to some investigators about it. And I can talk a little bit more if you want about, you know, one of the conversations I had with an investigator about it and where this sort of came from, if you want to.
Maybe we could get into that in a minute. There's one other angle to it that really intrigued me, and I want to see if we can have a little bit of a conversation about it. Because again, you know, you always bring the sex angle into this, you know, which is something that I have to say, you know, you've just made me kind of look there in a way that is cool, because I wasn't looking there before. Even the last time we talked and you said, yeah, and look at the sexual angle as it relates to the paranormal. Mm-hmm. And then you go, oh, shit, man, what do you do with that? What do you do with the demon who raped me? You know,
right.
What do you do with the positive angel who had intercourse with me? You know, I mean, suddenly, and then you had a couple of other cultural touch points with that. And I was like, wow, there is a lot there to pull apart. And then, you know, the thing I've gotten interested in a lot lately is the whole ET thing. And some people are saying, well, there's an ET spiritual transformation kind of connection. But then there's also the ET sex thing, you know? And it, again, if you look at, like you were saying in the porn thing, or if you look at the porn literature, you know, that's a super popular topic. I mean, you write about how my encounter with Bigfoot, man, those things go through the roof. Same with my encounters with ET or the reptilian, super popular stuff. So, you know, what's going on there in terms of the whole spectrum of sex and the extended consciousness realm? Do you have any thoughts going in?
Yeah. So that to me is so fascinating, and it's something I'm going to keep an eye out, you know, for as I begin to do the research, but I've already sort of looked into it. So for instance, okay, so here's a really simple example. So my friend Mona El-Tahawi, who is on my show a couple episodes back, she's an Egyptian feminist writer. She's Muslim, and she's like really into sexual liberation. And she brought up when I told her what I was going to do, she's like, oh, well, there are these, you know, women, Muslim women will sometimes say that they've been captured or possessed by a jinn, or they've had sex with a jinn, like a genie. And so therefore they can't have sex with their husbands anymore. And we both kind of laughed for a second. And then I said, well, isn't it so interesting that we laughed and we just automatically assumed that like what was happening there was a way to sort of escape the power that's in the home? You know, like maybe for some people it is, but like why should we immediately disbelieve the person? Or, you know, account after account after account of people that have had sexual encounters with or been either consensual or non-consensual with, you know, supernatural entities, with ghosts, with demons, or, you know, how, if you want to make it not so supernatural or whatever, you could say, you know, with aliens, although I know they have a supernatural aspect. But so when you get into accounts where people say that they've been raped by a supernatural entity, how do you handle that in the sort of believe the victim's Me Too narrative is an interesting question to me. Because if the idea is that you believe the victims, you know, when they say, hey, I've been raped, and, you know, maybe you don't have all the evidence in place, but it's important to believe me because a whole history of silence around assault victims has existed before this. What do you do with the people where the assaulter isn't present and you don't believe that the assaulter exists? This is a really interesting question to me. And it's not, and it's funny because even to bring that up, people think that you're demeaning rape or sexual assault by bringing these other accounts in. But to me, that's, that tangle of questions is so, has so much that it can tell us, you know? And I think, you know, other things, you know, another example I brought up, this woman, Ida Craddock, who around the time of the World's Fair here in the U.S., she was teaching women how to experience sexual pleasure. And she was hounded to death by Anthony Comstock, the guy who ran the society, what is it, Society Against Vice or whatever, the guy who was just, you know, like making sure that nobody was sending any information about sex or pregnancy or anything in the mail, because that's that, and he would arrest you. So she was hounded to death by him, literally. She killed herself because she was hounded so frequently by him. And she said she was married to an angel and that she had had all these sexual encounters with an angel. And people like to dismiss that and say, oh, well, she was just doing that so she could stay single and blah, blah. Well, maybe so, but that's not the language that she used. She used language of saying, no, I'm married to an angel. I have this whole sexual love, emotional relationship with this spiritual being. And so, and then of course, you know, nuns are married to Christ. So you have like this whole connection of supernatural, paranormal, spiritual, and also extraterrestrial events that are in the sexual realm that people don't think of. So I'm not, the reason why I'm not going there first with my investigation is because that's something that needs to unfold and open up. People feel vulnerable about supernatural experiences and paranormal experiences and investigations. They feel vulnerable about their sexual, you know, encounters. And so, you know, I can't depend on that all just like showing up for me just because I meet some strangers and say, hey, have you ever had sex with a ghost? You know, you can't do that. So I got to sort of figure out, is this going to unfold naturally and all that? But that is a real concern for me and is something I'll investigate in literature, even if, you know, people aren't necessarily willing to talk about it, you know?
Great. Yeah, I'm interested to see how that unfolds because I think if you've already put that intention out there, to me, it just seems like fertile ground in so many ways. And it is so, so interesting and so unexplored, taboo, you know, stigmatized on top of stigma, you know, the stigma of paranormal and then the added stigma of the sexual. So it's a very, very interesting stuff. So tell people more maybe about the particulars. You're going to need a little bit of help getting to Ireland to do this thing. It's quite an undertaking, but you're often doing it, right?
Yeah. I'm often doing it. So I'm starting it in 2019. We're recording in 2018. I'm starting in 2019. And, you know, I mean, the first year is really a bunch of courses. And then I start doing the ethnographic work, the field work and that sort of stuff. And that is, that to me, all that I need help with. So please support me on my Patreon. if you like this conversation, if you like my show, I have it's patreon.com/ConnorBeebe, and you get all kinds of cool stuff just for sort of contributing to the mission there of having these deep discussions and conversations in accessible language. But I think that work that begins, that work that begins this coming year, yeah, it's a long project and it requires a lot of work. I mean, that's how anthropology goes, because you don't know if you're going to be able to secure all the contacts that you want. It moves and shifts because it's the only academic discipline. First of all, it's one of the only academic disciplines that takes the occult and the spiritual seriously. I mean, really seriously on its own terms, when it's at its best, and it doesn't always do that. But the other thing is, it's a discipline based on friendship. you become friends with people. Really, you become friends with people. You don't just fake it, you know. And some anthropologists are bad friends, but you become friends with people so you can learn about their relationships and yourself and the things that unfold in those relationships and listening and talking. And so you don't become friends with, I mean, some people become friends instantly, but you don't become friends with people instantly. So it's going to be a long work that I definitely need some assistance with.
This is, I think, really interesting stuff. And I think there's a lot of people will share my interest in saying, wow, that's really something that's going to bear fruit and we want to keep an eye on it. But I have an opportunity here. As a gay Arab porn star, you have kind of a neoliberal ghetto pass that I can't resist taking advantage of and engaging in maybe a conversation on the on politics and about some of the cultural things that are going on that are really completely different than what we're just talking about with regard to your PhD. And in a lot of ways don't hit directly with your Against Everyone podcast, but in a way kind of do as well. And that's because there is this unbelievable divide right now. And I think a lot of people are kind of talking about it from the outside and pointing at it and going, wow, what's with this? You know, it's impossible to have public discourse. And, you know, this group seems to be totally off in some la-la land and there's no getting together. And so I thought we might pull that apart. And It's interesting because when we started to have that conversation, one of the things that you said that, again, I really loved, I mean, it's so Connor in a perfect kind of way, in that you said, well, going into it, Alex, both you and I realize that it's kind of all bullshit anyway, because we're playing a consensus reality game, and we understand that in some way we don't fully understand consciousness is fundamental, and we're creating this reality, and all this other stuff is kind of a game outside of the game.
Okay, so yeah, so that's a good way to set it, because foundationally you're saying that we actually... we're on the same page. So now we can get into the particulars.
Yeah. And fundamentally on the same page. And really, you know, and I don't want to kind of drive that point into the ground, but it's like, you really got to be grounded in that. I mean, I think you really have to be grounded. You know, you're a Rudolf Steinian, you know, and I'm not so much, but I sure appreciate where you're coming from in that, in terms of that being your foundation, that being your base, and spirituality being your foundation and base, and, you know, who am I, why am I here, being the fundamental questions you have to get back to, so you're not going to get pulled too far with any kind of political bullshit, because at the end of the day, it's all political bullshit, and we will never know, you know, we're right. not ruling uh-huh. the world, and we're not have all the answers to how all this stuff is supposed to happen, so there's a humility that I think you can enter that conversation with, and hopefully I can too.
Right. Yeah. I mean, in some way, so it's good that you're setting the stage this way, because really at the sort of bottom of all my politics is like, you know, we really need to ask ourselves the question of what it means to be human, what it means to be a human being, and what exactly is happening here. You have to ask yourself phenomenological questions about the experience of being, and then your politics can stem and grow out of there, right? But the thing is, like, part of my experience of being human is that I become unmoored from that sometimes, you know? And so it's like, yes, I try to make that happen. But where I fail, where I can't see those connections, or I just haven't done the work yet, or I don't have time, I try to have some sort of ethical cohesion or sort of philosophical, intelligent philosophy around things, where the gaps are, or just say, I don't know. And they're like, I don't know. But yeah.
Great. So with that, let me jump into it from one angle, which is, you know, as you described, and if people get to know your work, you don't mind playing the role of the provocateur. Uh-huh. And that's cool, because I am right there with you, man. I'm kind of, you know.
You don't say.
Yeah. Why science is wrong about almost everything. You know? What do you mean? It's a giggle, you know? But there's something good about that. There's something about that that I certainly respect. So I guess I'm going to kind of push you a little bit and ask how much of some of these stances that you're taking is you being a provocateur, and as opposed to you kind of trying to dive deep into the underlying realities, be they political or conspiratorial or however we want to look at it. I mean, you sometimes pitch a lot of this commie work is wrong, work is bad kind of stuff. Money is terrible. I mean, come on, that's not real. I mean, because at the same time, it's like I just listened to an interview, or I read an interview you did with, what's her name? Heather Berg.
Yeah.
At USC. I mean, here's a woman who's in academia at USC, which is like this elite private school, just dripping with money. And she's, you know, fighting for the working class sex worker, you know. I mean, it just doesn't ring true on so many levels. And I think you ring true a little bit more, because there are some injustices that have been done. But I mean, let's really pull apart the money thing. Let's pull apart the work thing. And I'll let you start, and then I'll attack you viciously.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, so what you're referring to, so I wrote and I co-authored an article. I mean, basically, it's a conversation between me and Dr. Heather Berg at USC called The Problem with Sex Work is Work. And in it, like, we just, the main focus of that is pulling apart why work sucks. I do believe that. So let me walk back for a second. A lot of the stuff I say is provocative. The thing that I actually do more than provoke, though, is I agree more than I agree. So on my show, I try not to disagree with people because I want to see what happens. It's not that I think that nobody should ever disagree or that that doesn't give anything in the world or debate doesn't give anything. But for me, it's not so valuable. For me, I'd rather see what happens on my show, particularly. Happy to disagree with you here, but on my show particularly, when we try to resonate with each other and see what happens, you know, what can emerge from finding the things that we're curious and interested about. So I do that more than I provoke, more than I provoke on my show. So a lot of stuff I say that might sound provocative, I do believe in. I do think that work is nonsense. I did an episode of my show that was just a solo episode called Work and Die, which is about how, work really kills. I have the statistic on the show and I can't remember it right now, but the thousands and thousands of people that like going to work kills, whether it's on the job, on the way to the job, being depressed, or, you know, because the job, stressed out, having health problems because of the job, or not having a job and searching for a job and killing yourself because you can't find one, whatever. Like, there are all these statistics done by different labor groups. And the idea being that, not that we shouldn't apply ourselves with effort to things that we are interested in, but the demand from our culture, from our government that says work or starve to death, work or, you know, or watch your family die because they don't have insurance, work or this, work or that, you know, that to me is what I'm defining as work, is a demand that you have to do things in a certain way to make money, which I don't think that the solution to that is right there for us. I think that we would have to take a lot of steps to get there. But my ultimate goal would be that we don't need to have jobs anymore, that we can start to reorganize our culture in a way that is friendly to actually not having the same kind of economic system that makes those demands.
Yeah, that's fine. It's just completely out of touch with reality. No, okay. Okay, I couldn't resist. Let me take that back. But let me try and break it down. I guess my problem with that is it does seem to stand in contrast with the fact that the phony baloney lifestyle that we've created in the West, which is the most prosperous life in recorded history, has allowed people greater flexibility and greater freedom from the work or starve reality than at any time in history. You know, I like all these goofy reality TV shows, and I wind up watching all these Survivor shows a lot of times, you know. But if you watch like Alone, which was, I love that show because it encompassed both the need that we have really to be in a community, and that when we're put alone and made to survive on our own, it's not just the survival lack of food that gets us, but it's the lack of being with other people and how we need that. But I digress slightly, because what the show ultimately reveals is that work or starve is the reality that most people have faced throughout time, and also the reality that most people on this planet face right now. So they're just, I don't want to get too provocative, but just to hear you kind of talk, when Heather talk about, you know, how we shouldn't work and work shouldn't. There is a worker starve reality that's always been in place. Aren't you jumping a little bit far ahead of the game? It's easier now to avoid the work or starve reality than ever before. Mm. Move to Portland. Get a dog. They'll pay you $400 just to walk the streets, and they'll give you another $400 a month just to have a dog. I mean, there you go. It's not hard.
Yeah, so it's not – so a few things. One is that when I say, you know, when we're comparing, say, certain indigenous cultures that didn't have the same economic structure, where it's like, okay, but if you don't go and hunt and gather, you know, or do, you know, minimal agriculture, like, you'll die because you'll starve. What I'm talking about is a system that's set up by an outside human constructed force that same – you know, if you don't engage in a wage and labor relationship in a specific way, you're in a lot of trouble, right? So, like, even just thinking about how hard it's been for me to get to where I am. So I mean, great. I have a Patreon. I spend a lot of time in my day reading and writing, and that's awesome. And yet, like, I've had a lot of time in my life where it was like, am I going to make rent? Am I going to do this? Am I going to be able to eat?
So what? Grow up. That's the world. It's competitive. It's a highly competitive environment. The fact that we've removed that lowest layer of competitiveness, I don't know if that's good or bad, and we can have an argument about that, but you've never had to endure that kind of work or starve reality that so many people face.
I'm not saying boo-hoo, poor me. I'm saying I want that to be easier for everybody else. So like, I don't mind taking that on. Obviously, if I didn't, I wouldn't do it. But I want everybody else to have an easier time with it. So while I agree with you that some of the things that have developed in our culture are beneficial to giving us more time, more space, more creativity, I just want it to be better. I just want it to be better than this even for everybody. So it's not a question for me. Because I would not identify myself as like a socialist or a Marxist, whereas Heather would, and I think Heather's really brilliant, but we don't see eye to eye on everything. I wouldn't say that we need to get to like a perfect socialist or Marxist like economic structure that somehow takes care of everybody in some glorious like Marxist thing where everybody works in this sort of collective solidarity way that feeds back into this socialist system. I don't care about that. I just want it to be better for everybody. And I think there are lots of options for it to be better. So someone I feel much more aligned with is there's this guy named Fridtjof Bergman who in Detroit, he was noticing like, okay, everybody is like unemployed here. So instead of talking about how can we get them better jobs, like, let's talk about what can we do actually to sort of give you value and meaning to your day and also reconstruct the culture and an environment that you live in without just sort of jumping back into the easiest, you know, default place, which is like get a job at a bank and, you know, work 60 hours a week and all that. He was like, no, we have an opportunity here. For me, that's the interesting project is like, what other options are available to us that are better for people? I agree with you that it's out of touch with the reality, which is why it's an important project to me, because a lot of times the reality is really, really difficult for a lot of people, you know, and for me personally, of course, I find it difficult, but I'm not going to complain about that all the time. I just want to make it easier for people. I want people to thrive. I want people to have more ability to like do all kinds of other creative things.
I do too. And I hear that. I hear where you're coming from. And I guess what that stirs up for me is I spent a lot of time in my life trying to manifest that wealth, you know, and I was able to do it, but I spent a ton of time investigating how to do it. And I read every self-help, money-oriented, get rich by changing the fundamental workings of your brains and your belief system and all the rest of that. And it really educated me in kind of the, you know, one of the classic books in this field is the Rich Dad, Poor Dad kind of thing. Mm-hmm. The whole philosophy behind Rich Dad, Poor Dad is a guy who grows up with a poor dad. A dad who's intellectually very smart, has an advanced degree, but is like barely getting by. And the neighbor, the friend, is the rich dad who's figured it out. And the kid goes to school and he goes, hey, I want to manifest some of that wealth. And he starts copying the patterns and the behaviors and really the belief system of the rich dad. And I guess that's what I've tried to do as well. I mean, if you want to manifest wealth, go look at successful people and talk to them not about what they do. Talk to them about what they believe. Talk to them about how they see the world. And you will find that you can manifest all the things that you want. Not only money, but health, happiness, better relationships, all those things. And that to me is so ingrained in me as just a reality of how the world works that it pains me to see people take this kind of radically just misguided idea that money is the problem. I mean, you are such a highly competitive guy to reach where you are in terms of your PhD program. That's very competitive. For you to succeed in that world is going to be very competitive. And then I see people like you who jump over into this other realm and start talking about work and start talking about money and want to go, oh no, I don't want to compete there. I want to just, you know, kind of pretend like everything should be different, you know, that the whole thing should be oriented in a different way. And it's not, man. It's work or starve. It's competition. It's you rise to the top or you fall to the bottom. And we've already made the bottom not that bad. Like I say, move to Oregon, get a dog, and you get $800 a month.
I mean, move to, there are some countries that are better than this one at that, I think, right? But
no,
that's
because it's not good. Because it's not good. But go ahead.
Well, no, all I'm saying is that the bottom is could be raised a bit more. But it's a minor point compared to what I'm about to say. So let's leave it there for a second. So the thing that you're saying, okay, I agree with a lot of what you're saying, which is like talk to successful people about their mindset, all that sort of stuff. I think that that's really important. And I think one of the hugest failings of leftist politics, in fact, the failing, I would say, is that it's left, is that spirituality does not exist there by and large. It's absent, or a conscious engagement with spirituality doesn't exist there by and large. And so all the sort of new age self-help stuff, you know, that I still have a hard time even talking about without laughing at it because of my own like ingrained stigma is like, I think that that stuff is so important. And in fact, a huge turnaround moment in my life was when I was like, you know, I should probably start listening to these people, right? But if we accept that as part of how the world works, which I do now, if that were available to everybody, it surely would change the economic system. So like if everybody was thinking in this sort of wealth consciousness,
no,
self-help, like
no, how that's not how it works, Connor. Again, how can you go from having this kind of expansive worldview of how everything can be better if we raise everyone's consciousness, if we all start thinking in a more fruitful, productive way, and then switch gears and get back into the scarcity model of saying, oh yeah, but if everyone did that, it's like, that's not how it works. Just manifest more for yourself in your life and help other people manifest more, and everything will take care of itself.
Well, see, but I agree with that statement you just made, but I don't think it was what you were saying before. And maybe it's because I misunderstand what you're saying, or maybe because we have an actual disagreement here. I think that, first of all, a lot of people are wounded by the way we talk about things in this culture, right? So, and some of it's personal responsibility, and some of it's a genuine cultural wound, where that kind of stuff doesn't feel as readily accessible to people for all sorts of reasons. Like this kind of, this mindset, this attitude, this abundance, wealth stuff, that for a lot of reasons is prohibitive for people. Now, I'm not saying that they can't get there. And I think that that's actually a really shitty statement to say that they couldn't ever possibly imagine that. I think that that actually is really wrong. But I'm saying that there's a lot of reasons why that people have a hard time embracing that,
how is that any
and understanding
than
how that works. Well, it's not. I think it's actually the same. So I just want to acknowledge that it's more difficult for some people than others to be able to access that. So like,
I don't want to acknowledge that. I don't want to go there because in the same way, and I'm interested in how you respond. I'm sorry to be peppering you with questions.
That's okay.
People hate when I do this, but I do it anyway.
I'm fine with it.
I drew you into the spiritual kind of thing. And you jumped right on there, which I think is awesome. And that's where we meet and have this kind of synergy. So it's like, you know, if we were to say what you were just saying and then said, substituted there, fundamentalist Christian or radical Muslim or fundamentalist Muslim or whatever you wanted to say, people would take offense and say, oh, you're saying that Muslims are unable to access this greater spiritual reality that is outside of their narrowly confined cultural kind of, let me make sure you get my point. Because it's like, I don't think there's much of a difference. And that's my point. I think culturally we kind of compartmentalize and have these different silos and say, oh yeah, you know, someone hasn't been exposed to, which there's an undoubtedly there's a reality of the fact that, and I've worked just a little bit with kids who are homeless kids and, you know, talk to them about money and about, and it's crazy to hear the kind of belief systems that they have because that's all they've ever experienced. So there's a reality to what you're saying, no doubt. But the ability to expose people to that and to change that reality and change that belief system, it isn't this monumental problem. And it certainly isn't framed up as the problem. What you guys are doing is framing up the problem as completely different. And I think what helps and is interesting to you and I is when we do the same thing, we would never say that about someone who's stuck in a belief system that's very limiting in terms of being a fundamentalist Christian or fundamentalist Muslim. We'd never say, oh, wow, you know, that's a belief system problem, and that's what we need to attack.
Well, okay, I might say that. I don't know. But I mean, I was more talking about, like, so when you talk about the homeless kids or whatever, I'm talking more about somebody who has three jobs because they've grown up in a culture that's like made them think that they have to have, like, you know, three, five, ten, you know, most people don't have 10 jobs, but people that are like working their asses off, like 80 hours a week, and like they don't have the psychic space to rest in the same way that when someone's really anxious, yes. Perhaps the problem is solvable by saying, well, don't be anxious anymore. But if you say that to someone who's in the middle of a panic attack, it usually isn't very effective. So all I'm saying is that there are ways to communicate to different kinds of people who are in different kinds of life situations, these kinds of lessons. And I think that we need to develop those a bit more. So some part of my project actually is talking to, like, let's break it down to a spiritual level, like, and say that these are in some ways spiritual principles when we're talking, well, in a lot of ways spiritual principles when we're talking about, you know, wealth and abundance and understanding money differently and seeing the world differently and all that kind of stuff. I am trying to talk to people that have all kinds of obstacles and ways of prohibiting those conversations from entering their communities, i.e. Marxists, leftists, all that. What I find is that a lot of them are actually really interested in these conversations, but have felt for whatever reason that they can't let it in or they can't embrace it. And I know that from my own experience as being someone who laughed at this shit his entire life until finally, like 3 years ago, I was like, you know, you have a lot going on for you. You're that, you know, poor dad in the book that you talked about. Like, you went to school, you've studied with some of the greatest thinkers in the world. You have a lot of really fascinating, interesting friends. You have a degree of public respect, but you have never had your money in order in your life. Why is that? And so when I finally dug down, I was like, maybe listen to the people that talk about how to do that a little bit more. It did change my life. And I still struggle with it. I think that there are unconscious obstacles that are in my way. I think that I haven't been as open as I need to be. So I'm taking some, you know, personal responsibility and all that in what I'm presenting as well here. But I just think, like, yes, go to put it another way, it's like, yeah, we can talk to some of these people that have been really successful. And then some of them, they're really successful, but they don't give a shit about helping anybody else at all, right? I mean, you talk about these people all the time on your show. There are plenty of successful, powerful, rich people who really don't give a shit about grinding everybody else down into the ground. So there's another component there that has to do with compassion and morality that's not just about success that I think is really important to bring these conversations. So for me, when I see somebody who's struggling with being able to allow a spiritual concept of money, or any spiritual concept at all for that matter, into their lives, I want to have the compassion that helps them to realize that and understand that. Does that make sense? I hope it seems on topic to you, because I realize I went a lot of different directions there.
No, it seems totally on topic. And I would relate it back to, I hope people are following this conversation or enjoying this conversation as much as I am, because I would rewind to the point where you talked about the inability of the neoliberalized left to connect with the spiritual part of that, because I think you draw out a good point. So if you are money focused, materialistically focused on manifesting that for yourself, and you're disconnected from the spiritual, compassionate part, we can all see that and point at that and go, oh, how terrible. But when we see the atheist Heather Berg USC disconnect, we're unable to do the same. We're unable to do the same and say, well, your compassion is disconnected from the deeper spiritual reality. That's number one. And you are therefore disconnected from this other reality, which is the spirituality of manifesting in your life. So it's like she's on shaky ground on both sides because she's occupying this kind of secular, atheistic work is this, detached from any kind of larger spiritual context. And then she's also detached from the reality of manifesting. And that's the frustrating part for someone like me.
Yeah. Well, I think I think it's a really good point. I'm like cringing a little bit because Heather's awesome and she's a good friend of mine and I think she's really smart. But I understand you're using her as an example, as emblematic of a certain kind of thinking. I think the Marxist labor focused flaw, and I wouldn't call those people neoliberals, but I do also think neoliberals have the same troubles in a lot of ways, is that it's not connected to spirituality for the most part. I mean, there are some Marxists that are doing it, I think that that's one of the major flaws. What I'm interested in, by the way, just as a side note, when I talk about politics, or when I talk about politics with Marxists, when I talk about it with socialists, what I think that they do really good is talk about the rights dimension really well. So they talk about tactics and how and why human rights matter for everybody. That to me is like the gift of that kind of thinking, because I think that like we need to talk about rights and we need to talk about culture and we need to talk about economics, all in really coherent and thoughtful ways. And so I think that the Marxists talk about the rights aspect really, really well. So something they're really good at talking about is like, it doesn't really matter if you like somebody or like the class that they're in or whatever, but you do need to grant them the same kinds of human rights as everybody else. And their focus is, I think, is a little off in that they locate it so squarely in labor and labor rights. But I do think that that's something that they're really good at and have developed a lot over time. So that's why I'm interested in them. I don't expect them to get the spiritual principles right. And therefore, their other perspectives are going to be skewed and not necessarily up to snuff. But that's why I try to have those conversations with them about them. And like I said, I find that they're all actually rather interested in them. And sometimes I encounter somebody who's just like, no, that's bullshit and that's stupid. And, you know, I just roll with it because I'm like, okay, this is what a lot of people say. This is, you know, your weird, dumb atheist arguments are not, they're nothing new to me and they're not like hurting my feelings or whatever. I just think that they're wrong. And, you know, but I do find that they're interested in those questions. They're just developing that aspect of themselves. And so I'm willing to allow people to like be in a developmental process, you know, that's all. So I don't mind when someone is like working on the rights sphere of our lives and tactics and labor laws and all that kind of stuff to improve the lives of others. As long as they're willing to engage in a curious conversation about the spiritual stuff, because I find that that develops in them, you know. I just want to say one thing real quickly about my sister. I don't really talk about my family that much publicly just because people give me so much shit online and in the world that I don't feel like letting them, you know, get like publicizing them too much so then they get shit. But like, you know, years ago, my sister, you know, she married a Catholic. So of course they were, you know, someone was raised Catholic. So of course they were like staunch atheists. And I told them about Rudolf Steiner and anthroposophy. This is a long time ago. I brought it up and she laughed at me. I mean, laughed in my face. And she brought her husband in and he came in the room and he laughed at me too. He was like, what? That's crazy and stupid. Years later, she works for an anthroposophical organization now, and he does too. So, meaning, like, I think that that process, it can happen in really – and I never pushed them again, you know, and now – and I always think to myself, now who's laughing, you know. But I don't – I think that that process can be very slow. But I do think that these conversations are really, really important, and I think that, like – when they happen with a in a spirit of, okay, what is this labor studies person saying that's resonating with me? What can I give back to the conversation that maybe they haven't thought about? You know, I think that that's really helpful. I mean, I realize I'm like taking Skeptico down a route of like, if we all just like have really sweet conversations with each other, everything will be fun. And I don't think that's true either. But I just want to bring that to you.
I think that's great. It's true, and it's consistent with who you are and what you do on your show, because it's hard to do that and maintain intellectual integrity. I admire that. So I appreciate you engaging in that dialogue. So let me then switch to kind of one other, because I think I didn't really know where we were going to go. And I guess I kind of ranted a little bit there, and you did a good job of kind of grounding it back to what it's really all about, which is this disconnection with these spiritual realities that we know are true, because no matter where you approach them, philosophically, scientifically, whatever, we're forced to move past this crazy atheistic materialism that is the standard play for everybody. So I'd shift that discussion similarly as it goes into conspiracy, because that's something I've been dragged into for the last couple of years, and people really don't like when I go there, and a lot of people have really kind of, they're just not able to go there. In the back of their mind, they think there's some underlying truth, they suppose, to the fact that things aren't really what they seem, that social engineering really is at play at every turn, but they don't really want to go there, and they just assume laugh it off. In the same way that you were talking about, I love the story about the woman you were talking to, the genie raped her so she can't have sex with her husband. And the first reaction is to laugh, ha, 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 ha. And then both eyes meet. You're like, is there any potential reality to that at all? And I think the same thing goes on with the conspiracy stuff. So if we want to talk about, you know, feminism is a great place to jump into it, because I think it connects to a lot of the other social movement interests that you have. But I passed along to you because I think it's so significant, so central to this. You know, the Gloria Steinem thing. And I always bring up Joe Atwell because I love Joe. He's just a great guy. I think he's so smart, and he's drilled into some of this stuff in some ways that other people haven't. But Gloria Steinem is CIA, you know?
Right.
And that's right. That's not conspiracy theory. That's like a real feminist finally investigated her and really drilled into it and interviewed her and nailed her on it. And she had to say, yeah, well, I was CIA, but hey, I had to be because, you know, the feminist cause was too important. And, you know, and a lot of people, that was enough. You know, that was like, oh, yeah, it was too important. And if that's the only way she could do it, then hooray for that. And we all kind of get there because it's like, yeah, there was a huge problem there in our society. But then when you fast forward and I sent you this link and you go,
right,
oh, but she's still at it. And now she's at it, you know, you have a Syrian background. Now she's at it in the strangest CIA way again, where she's protesting against the rights of women in Syria, you know, and it's like, it sounds good. And then you take a step back and you go, yeah, but isn't Syria more progressive than just about any other state that's around it, any other Arab state that's around it? And isn't Syria engaged in this death spiral battle with ISIS, who wants to burqa-ize every woman and just completely destroy their rights? Isn't that a curious position for Gloria Steinem to take? And then taking it outside of that narrow context right there, what does that say to the extent to which social engineering
right.
is at play with all this stuff where we think we're
there's so much of that going on. And I think that if people don't want to jump into grand huge conspiracy, take the first step, which is have the thought, okay, so here's something that I think is progressive, whether it's feminism or whether it's, you know, some sort of identity politics or another. Think about how people who are not really great people could use that against you. Just think about it. Take a moment and think about it, because they will. Because people in power, and with the institutions in power, in alignment with, as you've talked about on your show before, forces, including spiritual forces that are, you know, engaged in our behaviors and our actions, they will use anything they can against us. And one of the best ways to do that is stuff that looks really nice on paper. The feminist example is really personal to me, not because of the Syria thing, although that's bad enough with Gloria Steinem, but because of being in communities of sex workers, right? So earlier this year, there was a bipartisan law. There was a law passed by bipartisan effort called the Fight Online Sex Trafficking Act, or the Stop Enabling Sex Trafficking Act, FOSTA or SESTA, the sort of combination of two versions of this bill. And everybody voted against it everybody voted for it in the Senate, for example, except for two people, Ron Wyden and Rand Paul. And the whole thing was like, well, we need to stop human trafficking. We need to stop sex trafficking. We need to build. Great. I want to stop sex trafficking and human trafficking too. But as a sex worker, I know that the law conflates human trafficking with consensual sex work, okay? Or sex work that people have decided to engage in for a variety of reasons. So that's number one. But let's take it more to the sort of skeptico angle here. The meat of the law was that the government can seize or shut down any website for the behavior of its users. So if on Craigslist someone advertised for prostitution, which the government conflates with sex trafficking, then the government can shut Craigslist down, even though Craigslist had no control over what the user did on its own site. So through this law that looks like it's helping victims of human trafficking under the guise of a certain form of feminism, which was supported by like Amy Schumer and Seth Meyers and all these celebrities who are just complete blockheads, now the government has carte blanche to shut down any website with something that is beyond that website, the website master's control or the owner of the website's control, and that they can is so broadly defined that they can do it whenever they want to any website whatsoever, which has had a massive effect on like a lot of different sites and a lot of different avenues. So I'm using that as a really recent and prescient example of how these kinds of things happen. It can sound like the best law in the world, right? And it'll be backed up by an amazing ideology of feminism. And yet, what's actually happening there? What does that mean? And so you get the same thing with the Gloria Steinem bullshit. Or how about like Betty Friedan, you know, when she was like, you know, feminists, we aren't supporting Israel enough. We're going to have a lot of Israeli women that we need to support because the Palestinians, well, they're really into burqas and all that kind of stuff. Now, I'm not going to get enmeshed in the whole burqa, no burqa argument or, you know, hijab, no hijab argument. But I am going to say like, that was also calculated, and she pulled a lot of prominent feminists into that political realm. So these kinds of things are happening often and all the time. And to me, it's like you just have to keep that spinning in your head. What could be here that might be used against me in this progressive cause? You sound like yesterday it was like Rob Lowe, the celebrity on Twitter, said yesterday as of this recording, said, I saw Jeremy Corbyn call Theresa May a stupid woman. And so whatever the hell you think about Jeremy Corbyn or Theresa May, the entire like UK news media seized on that because Jeremy Corbyn wasn't a feminist enough because he called Theresa May a stupid woman. Again, I don't give a shit about what your feelings are about Brexit or Theresa May in this case. I mean, I do care, but and I have my own opinions on it. But it's like that it's so easily positioned. People can seize these things. So that's just the first level of things. Then you bring it up to the level that you talk about on the show, which is like there aren't people that are really calculatedly like trying to make these decisions and bring these kinds of things out. And then you take it up to the next level if you really want to go there and talk about, well, there are probably people behind them too, and then take it up to the next level and talk about forces, spiritual forces, whatever you want to say. But I think the doorway in is like that any reasonable person can engage with is what might be here that we should think about. I don't think a Russiagate thing is a very obvious example that more and more people I think are picking up on, like, there might be some problems with this whole like Russia narrative interfering with the election.
I've been slow to come around to the Trump bashing kind of thing because Trump so represents this possibility, this dream that someone outside of the system really can be outside of the system and not be a counterfeit, which if you look deeply, as I have just recently, into the crazy sexual shit, quote unquote, modeling agency where he's bringing over 12 to 15 year old girls and applying for these special visas, then his association with Epstein, which is much deeper and much more well-established than anyone wants to acknowledge in the media. He's right in the middle of that whole sex thing, and it could be different for him than the pedo thing that's going on, or different than the Pizzagate thing, or different than the satanic ritual abuse thing, which is something else we could pull apart because, you know, you take satanic ritual abuse and look at how that's processed through the society. As I throw those words out, there's a lot of people out there I know who are going, well, you mean the satanic panic, right? You mean the thing that didn't really happen, right? No, go three layers deeper, and you'll see that the children showed up with STDs. These young preschool children show up with STDs. All the ones at the preschool, or a large number of them at the preschool. How does that happen? They show up with tears, anal tears, and other sexual injuries. Well, how does that happen? So again, but the narrative that needed to happen was satanic panic. There's no such thing as satanic ritual sexual abuse. Disregard the fact that we have it documented here and here and here and with this cop and with that detective and all over the place. It becomes a rewrite of reality. And the reason I go there to the satanic ritual abuse thing is because it does launch us, as you described, kind of three layers deep.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, the satanic panic and satanic ritual abuse thing, it's worse than you say, because actually both those things are true, which is that some of it was bullshit and some of it's not. And so they use the stuff that's bullshit to convince us that the stuff that's real is not real. And then the stuff that's bullshit ends up hurting a lot of innocent people, and it allows them to control narratives about the occult and the paranormal and spirituality in our culture, that any investigation of magic or the occult or spirituality is like going to be satanic and all that kind of stuff. So it's leveraged in so many ways. And I think that the problem that people have is like, they'll go to one side or the other. They'll be like, oh, that was all bullshit. Well, sure, a lot of it was bullshit. You know, I'm sure that most kids who played Dungeons and Dragons in the 80s were not fucked up by it, right? Like, some of them were, right? Or, like, some of the abuse stuff, some of those abuse narratives were bullshit. And they ended up putting innocent people in jail. And some of it was real legitimate cover-up stuff. And when you look into it and you hear people talking about it, it's like, well, some of that shit was definitely going on. So is going on. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, is going on. I mean, I don't think you have to stretch too far back into history to just be like, well, we have a lot of evidence that, you know, throughout history, people, you know, in governments and of high status have like done, you know, really violent sexual rituals with people who did not ask to be involved in those violent sexual rituals. I don't think anybody would dispute that. So the idea that somehow it doesn't exist in our time is so naive. But I just want to say that, like, the picture is really complicated. So what people do is they go to one side or the other. They're like, oh, it's all real. No, all that satanic ritual abuse stuff, that's the grand narrative of our culture. Or they say, oh, no, it's all stupid. And it takes a lot more effort than that, unfortunately.
I'm with you. And I think you make a great point. But let's go down the path of it's the grand political, social engineering narrative of our time thing for a minute, because I really don't think that gets enough play. If Trump is our current sexual blackmail Roy Cohen kind of figure, which if people don't know who Roy Cohen is, you know, just go investigate, but admitted that sexual blackmail was his political tool of choice. And it has been for a lot of people. And J. Edgar Hoover was politically blackmailed for his gayness and his desire to dress up in women's clothing. And that's why he ran around for the longest time saying ridiculous things like, mafia? What mafia? You know, well, you say that when they have all the photos of you, you know, you'll say whatever they want. But you know, if you look at then and you start diving into this, I'm just going to throw out some kind of things here and then people will have to investigate on their own. But some people know, if you look at the Franklin scandal, tightly linked to the Republican Party, and then it was also the Callboy scandal related in Washington. It's hard. And then, of course, Pizzagate. And that has all these direct links, not only to child abuse and child trafficking, but to occulted and satanic kind of practices. And I hear you in that a lot of people don't know where to draw the line. But it seems much more common to me, and especially people in the occult and magic community, that they don't even want to tiptoe into those waters. I mean, Podesta Dennis Hassert. We have the emails. Why is Podesta talking to Dennis Hassert like this? What do they have in common? What they have in common is pedophilia, because Hassert is a convicted pedophile that the judge who sentenced him said, you know, you're one of the worst examples of this kind of horrific stuff that we've seen. And then if you look at Podesta, and all we have is circumstantial stuff. But I mean, anyone who's objective about looking at that, it takes you places that you don't want to go. So if I can spin all that back, how is this not the main political narrative of, I don't want to say our time, because we don't know how far back it stretches, but it just seems to be so much more prominent than anyone's willing to really acknowledge. And especially in your world, where I'm kind of attacking you and the neoliberal left. I mean, they are so detached from this, again, because their inability to deal with the greater spiritual reality that exists completely shuts them down from this. They just can't go there.
Yeah, I mean, they're completely incapable. I mean, one of the reasons why is because what we talked about at the top of the show. We are controlled and chained into not having conversations about sex, to not having conversations about politics, and to not having conversations about spirituality or even philosophy at this point. So all of those things are difficult for us to talk about for various reasons, which, you know, we probably don't have time to go into all the reasons why. But so we're, first of all, completely unequipped to even talk about it. So even if we got over that first hurdle of deciding to think about it and go into it, very few of us even have the language to have that discussion. So most people are inept when it comes to it. But I also think, I always come back to, you know, when we talk about Pizzagate, for example, I actually don't know all the particulars of Pizzagate. I don't know all the particulars about Podesta's emails and all that kind of thing. So in some ways, I fail to meet the demand that you would maybe have of me here. But what I do have is like, okay, well, I care about, I actually genuinely care about when, as much as I can without just losing my mind, when we drone strike villages in Pakistan and kill children, right? So why I bring that up is like, there's a cognitive dissonance about who's being harmed where, how we harm people, all that kind of stuff. To me, although I have not investigated the particulars of a lot of these child abuse scandals, would it surprise me that a government that is willing to murder kids with bombs and guns, you know, in foreign wars would do crazy shit like that in this country? No. And so I feel like my ethical and moral compass is in the right place, which is at least part of what's needed for this. Because I think also there's a way in which people go down these conspiracy rabbit holes, which I think sometimes really produce worthwhile information and perspectives for us, but they go down them as a way to distract themselves from the moral dimension of the thing that's happening all over the world in the first place. And that also, I think, is just as concerning for me, where it becomes this like whodunit, put all the strings on the board and connect everything together, you know, information game that loses its moral core, where you look outward into the world where you don't even have to do any of that work and see, yeah, governments and corporations murder and torture children. There's no question about that at all. And I should be really concerned of that on a worldwide scale. Now, it's both those things are still leaving out the whole dimension of this sort of spiritual aspect of, well, what does it mean that we might kill people, kill kids, torture kids, sexually abuse kids for a sexual, spiritual ritual in the world? What does that mean and what does that reveal to us?
I hear you, but you're kind of not answering the question. Here's the point. What interested me from the beginning about Pizzagate and about satanic ritual abuse and generally about sexual abuse of children, which oftentimes doesn't have anything to do with sex. It has to do with violence. And when I interviewed Bob Hammer, FBI agent, 20 years, who infiltrated NAMBLA, Man, Boy, Love Association, phony political front, and the conversations that he heard these men having were not about sex or love. They were about violence. They were about really horrible, horrific things that they wanted to do to children in ways that they wanted to harm them. But I digress slightly, because what that was really about to me was the question of evil. Because there's a moral ambiguity to Obama, who I'm sure you were referring to, drone striking weddings, you know, because Obama was the drone strike king in history, more drone strikes than anyone else. And he had a lot of children and he killed a lot of innocents and all the rest of that. And I say that slightly tongue-in-cheek because, of course, it happened before and it's happened since. But let's let Obama sit on the throne there because he won that prize. But there's a moral ambiguity to that, because we understand that we need to defend ourselves. So the Dalai Lama says, hey, if someone attacks you, it's okay to defend yourself. Gandhi says, hey, even though it's, you know, turn the other cheek and peace and all that, we do have a right to defend ourselves. So well-meaning people can have differences about how far that defense extends and what we should allow ourselves or our governments on our behalf to engage in order to defend ourselves. On the other hand, a lot of this sexual abuse and satanic stuff strikes us as something that is of a different ilk. It is evil in a way that we don't want to look at or fully come to grips with. It's evil in a way that I don't fully understand, but I'm open to wanting to explore, because I think there's something there that fits into this larger puzzle in terms of why someone would engage in this kind of evil. Do you get what I'm saying?
Yes. Okay. So first I want to agree with you, and then I want to turn something back to you. Okay. So the thing I want to agree with you on is, yes, there's definitely a distinction there. And anything that looks like satanic ritual abuse will reveal something different about evil to us that I think is important. But I would also just turn back to you and say, maybe like the more pernicious and horrible evil is in the kind of violence that makes us think that there's ambiguity about it. Maybe that's the thing that's actually way more evil. Because let's say somebody gets caught like red-handed skinning a child, and as some of these accounts are, and like hanging their skin on a tree. I think our society would condemn that, you know, unilaterally if they saw it in plain sight. We see images of people being burned alive, and it's public record, and we talk about that as winning and, you know, and as necessary and as ambiguous. That, to me, that spirit, that thing that's happening in that space is the thing that's the real, real horrific instance of evil. And it's not because it's more evil or less evil than, you know, killing and torturing the kid and satanic ritual abuse. There are distinctions there, and I think it's important to notice them. It's just that we greet it. We greet it with an enthusiasm. And that, to me, is really, really messed up. And it's something that we really need to look at. And that is hidden from us. That's a conspiracy all on its own. Why we celebrate that kind of thing. And I don't think it's good to just, I'm not saying you're doing this, but I'm going to use a forceful word. I don't think it's good to retreat or hide in ambiguity or the idea of complex decisions when it comes to that sort of thing. We have decided unconsciously, but then I've decided to go along with a culture that says that that's okay and that's ambiguous. And we have decided so deeply that we rarely even try to get ourselves out of situations like that or pull ourselves back from it or try to dial down the way that we do that in the world, the way that we export murder and torture across the entire planet. And a lot of nations do it. It's not just us, but let's take responsibility for the one we're in.
I get you, and it's a point well taken. And rather than kind of defend myself, because you got a point, and there's no question about it. The one thing I would add to that, though, is where I was coming at it from was it clarifies evil.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And on that, I think we agree.
Yes.
Because, you know, a lot of my efforts, I guess, has been kind of wanting to grab atheistic people by the shirt collar, you know, whether they be Heather Berg at USC with her phony baloney job, or, you know, some atheist who doesn't even, I know you're going to get a lot of shit from Heather. She's welcome to come on the show any fucking time. It's just ridiculous that someone would say those kind of crazy things. But anyways, to shake those people by the shirt collar and say, there is a larger spiritual reality that you got to swim in that pond before you can even begin to deal with some of this stuff. So it's almost like, you know, you see one entry point and I see another entry point. I see the entry point as being provocative and saying, yeah, satanic ritual abuse. Look there, it's real. And it goes all the way up in the White House, and not just the Trump White House, but the Obama White House, the Bush White House, and, you know, over and over and over again. So it's like, that to me is the doorway to saying, for some people will say, oh, I do need to wake up to that. Versus I think it is harder for people to wake up to the drone strike, which is an extension of the firebombing of Tokyo, which is an extension of Holocaust of the Druids by the Romans, which is an extension of, you know, we've seen all that shit before.
Yeah. I mean, I think like, just like, I don't want to dismiss the ritual abuse stuff or other instances of human sacrifice and strange occult acts of black magic in high places as not interesting. They're very interesting. And I think that the way you just said it, where you say it clarifies what evil is, that's a really interesting way of looking at it. Because I think, you know, people tend to think of evil as like, oh, well, you know, everybody's just wounded and they're just acting out of the wound. Like, no, that's bullshit. And you and I both know that that's bullshit because I've heard you talk about it and call people out on that and say, like, no, that's bullshit. It is total bullshit. What's happening when someone's evil is that they are they've reached a state where they understand their wounds, and they're still deciding intentionally to align themselves with certain forces in our cosmos and in our world to, I think the way Mark Booth might have said it, I love using him as an example because he says so much and so eloquently, is that as counterforces to the evolution of humanity. And we could unpack evolution of humanity and counterforces and all that kind of stuff if you want, but it's essentially it means like I'm aligning myself with beings that want to undo love and compassion in the world. And I've done that intentionally. I've done and freedom and free will. And I've done that intentionally. Someone can, I mean, this is going to sound strange, but someone can murder somebody and it won't be evil because they're doing it because they're crazy and they're compulsive and they're acting on a wound. They might be in the sway of something that's evil, but they themselves are outside of their own free will. Evil, I think, requires free will because evil requires intention. Otherwise, it's reflexive, it's compulsive. So evil is rare, but it's horrific when it happens. And I think that both the satanic ritual abuse stuff and wars at a certain point up the ladder are acts of evil. Whether everybody involved in those acts are evil people or doing evil themselves and not just sort of in the sway of something as if they're hypnotized or in a trance, that's a different question.
I think you put your finger on something, and I like how you reference Mark's thing, because I gave Mark a pretty hard time about his kind of very Christian worldview, and I have a lot of respect for him. I think he's brilliant in so many ways. And I love what you said about Mark and the counter-evolutionary thing. And I guess let me tip my hand a little bit in that I think that is so accessible to all of us in a very personal way. If we're really honest, what are your thoughts on that?
I want to say that one of the urgent questions ahead of us is to all ask ourselves consistently, am I evil? is to keep that question in mind, because you're right, it can become that. It's almost like the opposite of being, when people say it's crazy, it's like if you can ask yourself if you're crazy, then you're not crazy. If you can ask yourself if you're evil, then you actually do have the potential to become evil. Because if you never ask, then you're just in the sway of compulsive sleepwalking forces like everybody else. And, you know, nothing you do is really evil, but also nothing you do is really good. Like, you're not really acting out of intention at all. So you're not really able to extend love and compassion for real in an intentional, purposeful, and meaningful way to people. So you have to ask yourself, am I evil, to be able to extend? And that is the gift of the possibility of evil to us. That's the gift of free will to us, is that the separation, the ability to do evil means that if we look at that, we ask ourselves that, then we can do good in the world, if that makes sense. So I think that it takes a lot of work to do evil in the sense of, yes, it's available to all of us. But so you do evil. Okay, so you're an evil person. You do lots of horrible black magic in this world. And I define almost all evil as black magic, honestly. So I am not on board with spiritual people or cultists are like, oh, who cares? Black magic, white magic, gray magic is all just, you know, whatever. No, I'm not down with that. And there are lots of reasons for that. But I think it's like, yes, if you do black magic in this lifetime, you're doing evil. Okay, so you die. So then you die and you have a life in between this life and the next life. And then you're reborn again. And so then you probably won't do evil in the next lifetime. So, okay, so you did evil in this one. You know, the way the universe works is we have free will and these experiences are available to us in one way or another. There's a really curious, almost hidden little thing that Rudolf Steiner says somewhere, and I don't exactly even remember where it is, but he says, if you do evil in one lifetime, okay, that sucks. You shouldn't do it. But everybody who's been a great spiritual master has at some point been a black magician in a past lifetime. Why? Because they need to understand the totality of human experience, so they have to go through that trial. So even the people who have become mass, actually Daskalos said that, and Cypriot Healer, but he said, you know, so look, because they need to experience the totality of existence to understand the real depths of humanity. So on a sort of cosmic scale, it's that idea that I was talking about before, like you have to ask yourself if you're evil to be able to do good. We have to do evil to do great good in another lifetime. I'm not proposing anybody do evil, but I'm just saying we go through these lifetimes. Rudolf Steiner said this very curious thing somewhere. where he said, if you do evil in one lifetime, fine. If you do it in 13 lifetimes in a row, I don't know where he came up with that number, but he said, your soul will be obliterated. Now, in my understanding of spirituality, our being is that we are all our own universes, and we're becoming our own universes. So if you do evil 13 lifetimes in a row and you obliterate your soul, you've made a black hole out of yourself. And a black hole sucks everything into it. And that is really counter to humanity. You've done something really grievous. You've done something really horrible. You've aligned yourself with forces in the universe that really are trying to make you a sink that pulls everything into nothingness. So that is what happens with evil, as far as I'm concerned. And there's a lot there that we could go into, but I know we're getting to the end of the episode, so I just let people sit with that, I guess.
Sit with it, they shall. Again, our guest has been Connor Habib. Connor, it's been absolutely great entering into this dialogue with you. I think it's so rare. I've never had a chance to talk with anyone in this way on Skeptico, so it's a great gift. Check out Connor's podcast/video vidcast Against Everyone with Connor Habib. And how else can people reach you and follow your progress towards your very interesting PhD work we were talking about?
Yeah, one of the best ways to interact with me, because I really interact with people on there, is through my Patreon. And even if you just pledge $1 a month, but or you can pledge more, I respond to everybody on there. And that's patreon.com/Connor Habib. It gives you links to all the podcasts, to stuff I'm writing and working on. And, you know, if I still nevertheless appreciate everybody, if you want to follow me on Twitter, it's just at @ConnerHabib, at Connor Habib on Twitter. And also, you know, by subscribing to the podcast.
Great, Connor. Well, best of luck, and let's stay in touch, right?
Yeah, we will.
Thanks again to Connor Habib for joining me today on Skeptico. The one question I tee up from this interview is the question I teed up at the beginning, and that is there a disconnect between progressive social causes that we all identify with and believe in, universal love and harmony and freedom and justice? Is there a disconnect between that and spirituality, in that do any of those things make sense in an atheistic biological robot paradigm? So that's the question. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Join me on the Skeptico forum, or just send me an email, or reach me on Facebook. Any way you want is good for me. I'm here at skeptico.com, skeptiko.com. where I make available all these shows for free, for download, to use in any way you like. So that's going to do it for this episode. I have some good ones in the can, a little bit slow in getting them out. That's why I'm increasing and kind of doing every week, because I wind up doing more interviews and then I can't get them out in time. So they're going to be coming every week for a while and then back to every other week. But anyways, there's some good ones coming up. Stick around for all of that. Until next time, take care. Bye for now.